Namaste, good morning, everyone. There's this Persian couplet which I'll read out. It's easy to come with me. I am standing in the middle of the bazaar and shouting, come with me. All you need to do is to burn down your house and come with me. It is easy to come with me. Take off your head and follow me. The house is the wall of separation, and the head is the head full of beliefs based on our conditioning. So what is being pointed at is to keep aside all that one has picked up, so to speak, keep it aside for a moment and be open to what is being offered by a master, teacher, teaching. At the same time, we can't help approaching anything from our conditioning. But what is being sought here is a small opening, at least that little bit of room that is given, that is allowed for a different perspective, something one has not heard before, perhaps, to shine through, or something that is one's life experience, one's deep knowing, but has been brushed under the carpet out of fear, out of social confirmation, beliefs, and so on. My teacher Rameshji was very clear that he had to address all the questions of the ego, because after all, he was talking to the ego. That was his approach. He could understand the mass of confusion that seekers came to him with. Maharaj's approach was different. He said, I am talking to you as consciousness talking to consciousness. The other thing that tends to happen, in all earnestness, of course, and with such availability today, access to so many teachings, teachers, etc., is we try to compare one teaching with another, or what one speaker or teacher says with what another says, and we try to join the dots. In the instances where the dots get joined, there's a confirmation. But then there are those instances where they don't get joined. Then there's confusion. This is how the mind operates, you see. One has to be careful. I myself have got emails in the past. This teacher says this. What are your views about it? This person says this. There's no point in that, because everyone is approaching it in a contextual situation. What is in context at that moment? But the mind is doing the comparing and judging. This one has to watch out for. In this quest, we tend to lose focus. If we follow too many things, as Bhai Sahib had said, you cannot ride two horses at the same time. By all means, stick with one that you feel you are closest to and explore the rest. Everyone has something valuable to add. But when that clarity is not there, that this is the one which has given me what I want, whatever, then it creates confusion. The other aspect is that we drop a set of old beliefs and concepts and pick up a new one and then get stuck with those. Those are still pointers. So let's say we had a belief that we have free will, and then something comes along and shows you that that wasn't really true based on your own experience. Then the belief becomes, I have no free will. And we are stuck at the other polarity. And what masters like Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi are saying is that these polaric opposites, free will and no free will, need to be transcended. The jnani has transcended both. It's not a question of free will or no free will for the jnani. And as he would say, when you take one thorn to pull out a thorn which is in your foot, you need to throw both away. That is when one is at peace. Now let's take up some questions I have received on the email. This is from someone who has been following many non-dual teachers. My total business has become sick after COVID as we deal with education products. Now, as I took a loan from the bank against mortgage of my house, as well as relative's house, how can I use your teaching in this great crisis? If I think I am not the doer, all is God's will, I can easily accept to lose my own belongings. But what about my relative's belongings? If the bank takes away the mortgages, the present scenario is very much like this. I've got a notice from the bank. Is there any responsibility from my side to protect their property from the bank, as well as my parents and relatives will suffer after losing their only house because I am unable to pay the bank's money? What is your teaching in this scenario? Please guide me. Firstly, I can fully understand the pain this person is going through. Being in a financial crisis shakes up one's view on life. After all, it is directly linked to the fear of survival. I am reminded of a time after my father's passing. He had an advertising agency. And we were cash strapped because in those days, which is going back 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, the agencies had to pay the newspapers and magazines for the ads run of the clients, whether or not the client paid. The agency was accountable. And ours was a small agency. And I recall that my mother had taken a loan of 100,000 rupees which perhaps translates as about $1,200, from a friend of my father's who was a multimillionaire, industrialist. And perhaps a few weeks after giving that loan, the accountant of the industrialist started hounding us to repay the loan with interest. And I was quite taken aback. It literally opened my eyes to what kind of world one is living in. Sometimes we are found in these situations. I don't say we find ourselves, we are found in these situations. When things were happening in these teenage years and early 20s, I remember reading one joke, those cartoon strips. Where a man is holding a gun at another man and says, "I have good news for you and bad news for you. Which would you like to hear first?" And the man replies, "Oh, please give me the good news first so that the bad news is cushioned." And the man says, "All right. The good news is that I am going to shoot you." And the man is shocked. He said, "If that is the good news, what is the bad news?" And the man with the gun replies, "The bad news is that there is no more good news." I sometimes felt like we were in that situation. Many of you who have seen moments in life where things go wrong together, all at the same time, would understand this sentiment. And this brings us to this interesting subject of money, which is too vast to cover in such talks, but perhaps to just touch upon. Where does the teaching of Advaita come in this scenario where the person has mortgaged the assets of family and relatives? This should have been thought about at the time of taking the mortgage. But perhaps in one's enthusiasm to do well, to start a new business, we don't anticipate such scenarios arising. Therefore, Advaita does not absolve you of the consequences of your actions. Deep down, you may know that the events were beyond your control, including your decision to mortgage the relative's assets. It was a happening. So deep down, you may know that. There may be acceptance that what has happened was meant to happen, else it would not have happened. The results are never in one's control. Therefore, one is prepared to face the consequences, and therein lies the peace. This teaching does not absolve one of responsibility to others, to society. The point is, all this teaching can provide one with is a deep peace. That, in spite of my best intentions to have a go at it, to be successful in this business, it was not God's will. I regret having borrowed money from the banks. I regret mortgaging trusting relatives' assets. I apologize for the same, for the mess which I have got everyone into. And now I deal with the situation as it presents itself. So one becomes more available to deal with the situation in the best possible way, because the mind is not entangled in blaming oneself, blaming the bank, blaming others, in guilt, in shame. Because if the principle of non-doership is grasped at the heart, the thinking mind is free of all this burden. It does not mean one becomes reckless and says, oh, it is all God's will, so I'm not accountable to my relatives. This has to be looked out for. Now, keeping this question aside, one will find quite certainly that when one is following the teaching of Advaita in whatever way and capacity, one's relationship with money changes. One becomes more relaxed with money. One becomes more relaxed with giving money. Because the ego's identification with this money as mine is reducing. So if someone owes you money, or let's say someone gave you a bad tip on the stock market and the shares crashed, you have this knowing deep down that this money, which is owed to me, will come back if it is God's will. This stock crashed because it was God's will. You may still feel a financial pain at the loss. The teaching cannot take that away. But when you are no longer invested in the story that he gave me this tip, I listened to him, I should not have, I hold him accountable. How could he give me such a tip without doing his research properly? And so on and so forth. You see, when all this dialogue is stripped away, the loss is seen for what it is. A loss that was meant to happen. Perhaps I learn from the experience and try my best to ensure it does not happen again. That's all I can do. Further, giving money. Let's say in charity, perhaps a beggar on the street, rolling down the window, giving some money, is no longer seen as a favor being done. I am giving money. When the sense of doership is removed from this equation of money, what is realized is that in any case, this money is not mine. I earned it in some way based on my capabilities and attributes which God made. So even when money is being given, the quality behind that giving is very different. We are not feeling that our reserves are being depleted by giving the money. Now we know this has come from somewhere by the grace of God and is going somewhere by the grace of God. The ego which steps in and says, I am feeding the poor, I am being generous, that goes out the window. So if we have this awareness consciousness when we are giving a gift to someone or money to someone, maybe a loved one, maybe a stranger, that it is truly not mine. I am just a part-time custodian of it. Then you see what happens is, like all relationships which get transformed with this teaching, our relationship with money gets transformed. This does not necessarily mean more money will come in, this, that, etc. It means the grip that money has on our thinking mind starts loosening up. That is why I find these teachings are so practical. Someone had asked Rameshji in the satsang, every once in a few months he would spontaneously thank someone who had given him a donation or dakshina in the satsang. Like let's say a Peter or John or Aditya. He would just say, oh, thank you for your donation. So someone asked Rameshji that, is this appropriate that you announce this in satsang, because then all of us feel we have to give. Why not keep it quiet? And he replied, he said, but that's what you are feeling. I have been a bank manager for so long. I'm very natural and spontaneous with money. So if someone has given it, I'm thanking that someone. As simple as that. It's what concepts we build up around money and then project it onto others. At the same time, I remember once I was in his bedroom. I would go before the 9 o'clock satsang and just spend some time with him and his wife. And so he pointed to a cupboard and it had a kind of a separate shelf or something. And so he said to me once, he said, you know, whatever cash donations come in, dakshina, people would give in envelopes and all, he says, it's on that shelf. And my whole house, including my grandchildren, I tell them, take what you want from there, no need to inform me. A relationship with money. Now in some spiritual traditions, they really break your relationship with money. The severe ones tell you to donate all of it if you want to come onto their path. Some Sufi traditions, like Bhai Sahib's, for example, he would say that mostly, even in religion, what they say, keep 10% aside for tithing, for giving away. Earn a salary, keep 10% aside. And in our tradition, it is the opposite. The first 10% has to be given, not the last 10%. You see the difference? Because if one is to trust the Almighty, then that for them is a measure of that trust. The first thing that comes, let it go. Not first I get my monthly salary and then I take 10% out of it and I start donating. All relative, of course, because we all have families to feed, etc. But what were they pointing to, you see, these great masters? Is to shake up this hold that money has on us. It is like you see some roadside tea stall vendors in Mumbai setting up their stall early in the morning, doing the puja, whatever. And making the first cup of tea, sugar, this, that, milk. And then you see them turning around and pouring it down onto the road. They are offering the first cup to Mother Earth. This is on karma. One thing that keeps coming up with me is Rameshji says that the ultimate truth is the impersonal consciousness from that everything permeates. When everything is impersonal, then the theory of karma is also impersonal. If there's no one doing anything and the totality is functioning through each body-mind organism, that means the so-called karmas associated with each one of us is also impersonal. There is no personal karma attached to anyone, so to say. But on the other hand, why do we get entangled in this vicious circle of karmas? Before coming to this teaching, I believed that my whole life is because of my past karmas, and the other so-called teachings also said that the family, parents, environment, and all other things associated with you is because of your past karmas. When life puts you in such situations, sometimes you start to believe that yes, this is all happening because of your past deeds. All the people you are closely linked to are there with you for a reason, for you to learn lessons and all of that. But after hearing Rameshji, this seems immaterial. I often think, why would I hurt or do something wrong to another person? I am not doing anything, all is just happening. The words, deeds, situation, and everything around you is just situational and is happening. In one of his talks, Rameshji said that very, very few people get this understanding correct, and the source chooses such people. When the consciousness decided that there will be ego, at the same time, consciousness started its process of awakening. If we look at the whole scene, then the ego is also not ours. It's something which was made to be present in this whole drama. Please do explain this karma theory in the light of impersonal consciousness. You see, karma cannot be explained in the light of impersonal consciousness, because then karma for whom? As Rameshji would say, karma literally translates as action. Full stop. For the individual, this question, of course, is most beautifully put from someone who has dived deep into this whole subject of karma and the impersonal consciousness, etc. But karma is based on actions, based on doership. It is the sage who is free of the karma of doership, not the average individual. It is the enlightened being. You see, it's very simple. Let's take a situation with a friend and you have an argument, or a companion, a partner, and you start playing this tennis match. Oh, you said this to me, how dare you? And then the other person talks, and then the other person, then the other person, then that action reaction loop is based on doership. You did something, therefore I am doing something. That creates the bondage of karma. If doership is pulled out of this equation, that tennis match, action and reaction, loses this property of shuttling back and forth. It is dropped. If there is the total acceptance that nobody is the doer of the actions, including me, then all the associations based on doership are wiped out. And what one is left with is the situation one has to face. That is not wiped out. Ramana Maharshi himself was taken to court at one point. But did he blame and accuse the person taking him to court? Did he get into, why am I being taken to court? So the sage is out of it. The ordinary person has to see his relationships. Is he or she out of it or not? One is an intellectual understanding of the theory of karma. Two is, are we living the understanding? That is more important rather than getting lost in the conceptual framework of karma. That's why my teacher would not delve deeply into this whole topic, because it feeds too much to the thinking mind. And as the Sufis say, and the Persian Sufis, the mind is the shadow of shaitan, of the devil. It's like a dog chasing its own tail, going round and round and round. So rather, focus on peace of mind through relationships, be it people or be it objects in your environment, be it money, whatever you have. And see the doership associated with these objects. So rather than getting stuck in based on past lives, based on this life, this, that, the focal point is, where are you here and now in relation to your peace of mind? Now, Sai Baba of Shirdi could see the bondage of relationships going across generations. Oh, does this mean there is a past life? Does it mean past deeds? That's how the ego operates. What was he pointing at? That everyone who comes into your life does not come by accident. There is a divine mechanism behind that. The point is, what are you going to now do, so to speak, with the person in front of you, with that relationship? Are you going to free that relationship from the shackles of judgment, opinions, hatred, jealousy, envy, condemnation? Or are you going to accept that before me is an instrument of God, just as I am? God appearing as individual being, as Joel Goldsmith would say. I'll read out something which I had kept open on what Ramana Maharshi says about this question of karmas for the sage. Bhagwan was more concerned about you and me and how we could also have a link with the self. That day he quoted a verse that expounded the truth about the three karmas. Sanchita, which is the karma accumulated from our past lives. Agami, which is the new karma we create in our present life. And Prarabdha, the karma to be worked out in this life. So you could say Sanchita is the mother load of karmas, from which a portion is given to be worked out in this life, which is the prarabdha, and the agami is the new karmas we are creating based on doership. According to the scriptures, for jnani, sanchita karma and agami karma get nullified. Means the mother load of karmas is wiped out and the present life karmas are wiped out. But he still has to experience prarabdha karma, which is the karma allotted to this life. Bhagwan has rejected this by a humorous analogy. He says, when one is beyond the control of the mind and the body, it is not possible to say that two karmas are nullified and one karma alone will stick to him. Imagine that a man is married to three wives. If he dies, all the three will become widowed and not the two of them. Rameshji would say destiny is for the body. Not the consciousness. In deep sleep, where is the question of destiny going to arise? To whom? Can you please speak on any parallels between the acceptance of reality not as a concept but as direct experience and enlightenment as defined by Ramesh? And then there's a quotation of Ramesh's. The total acceptance that I am not the doer of my actions and nor is the other means the total acceptance that everything in the world is a happening according to God's will. So the question is, can you please speak on any parallels between the acceptance of reality not as a concept but as direct experience as defined by Ramesh? So simple. So simple. Let's keep aside the word enlightenment and replace it with enlightened living. Day-to-day living. Nothing in the air, nothing as a mystical experience. Something directly linked to my peace of mind here and now. I'll give you a right example which happened a couple of weeks ago and how the teaching changes the whole equation. We had in our small business someone we had nurtured, a young girl when she joined us, young girl who was not really qualified for the data-centric job we had hired her for, but she was nurtured by us over, and she was with us for over 7 years. And so when the data manager resigned, we encouraged her to take up that role. Very nervous, very introverted, very not confident to have people under her. But we felt she could do it. And so this relationship grew over a span of 7 years. Now, 2 weeks ago, she put in her resignation with the caveat that in 15 days I'll be off. Now, what can one do in such a situation? It is a work from home environment. Hiring is difficult. Leave alone handover will take longer than usual. One would expect that at the level of manager, the resignation as per outlined in the terms would be 60 days and so on and so forth. The reality presenting itself, so to speak. Now what happens? This entire blame game does not arise. How dare she do this? How could she have done this? She worked with me for 7.5 years and she did this. What has human nature come to? And blah, 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 blah. Is finished. It had to happen, so it happened. It's unfortunate it happened this way. Shall I express myself? Of course, if I feel like. I wrote a mail saying that in these times, such short notice. Of course, our best wishes are with you to grow, but what about the handover? That's all one can do. One can't go to court, especially in India. And yet one knows that perhaps she needed a change after 7.5 years. Something better came along, as she told us. She had to take it because they told her you have to join immediately. So you see, one is no longer judging a person or a situation. We accept that there's trouble now because things are shaken up, a new person has to come, etc., etc., and so forth. How to find someone good? Will it happen? What will we do in the interim? And so we just requested her that if she could still continue while in her new job till someone falls in place, even if it means allocating fewer hours, just ensuring that customers' orders get processed, which she has said, of course, she'll be there for. So this is where this teaching is no longer pointing at some mystical experience of enlightenment, but bringing it down to a basic quality of living. Living the teaching, which eventually becomes being lived by the teaching. As Joel Goldsmith says, you can't bypass the mind. Let it go through the mind into the depth of consciousness. And when it flowers there, that becomes the new way of living, of seeing things, of seeing people, of being. It truly makes life simpler. Rameshji would say, it may not make life easier, but makes it simpler. But in many instances, we find that it makes life even easier. And then one is living the dictum of Ramana Maharshi. Let what comes, come. Let what goes, go. And see what remains. All right. If anyone would like to ask any questions or share anything, they are welcome to do so now. One request is to please, if you are in a noisy environment, after you ask your question, to mute your mute button so that it doesn't disturb everyone, including me. And also, if you are walking with the camera or it's shaking, then the feed gets disrupted and it starts breaking up. So it's better to perhaps, you know, not move too much when you are talking into the camera. Yes, Shwet.
Hello, Gautam, sir.
Hello.
So I have a question. Why do we see so much immorality in the world today? Is it because of the influence of Kali Yuga? And second question is COVID because of some collective karma of humanity? Or again, that is an influence of the times we live in?
The answer to both is both are because of God's will. That's it. Of course. Everyone has a role to play in that. We as human beings, everyone is playing their part. and we are in the realm of cause and effect.
Mm.
One thing is linked to another. That cannot be ignored.
Mm.
But ultimately, whatever is happening is God's will. It's
God
as
is in
simple
some,
as that.
God is in some individual being, we are saying, no, right?
No.
Someone sitting out there.
God as consciousness, the source, all that there ever is, there ever was, and there ever will be. The unicity,
so every,
the totality.
So every act happening is orchestrated already?
Yes.
Everything?
Yes. All right. Thank you. I'm just going to close some windows which I've opened up, some updates or something. All right. I wanted to just touch on one more email, very short one. It's about someone who says, seeking on the outside with my identity is always for being who'd completely accept and unconditionally love me. At the same time, through your talks and similar pointings to the truth, I understand that accepting oneself, loving oneself unconditionally becomes a prior necessity before really seeking outside for such a space. When such an acceptance happens, I find there's just tranquility, non-judgment, and being. Everything vanishes. The mind becomes still for some time, and even so does the body. However, some situation soon triggers back the same personality bundle of reactions and expectations. I guess going even more deeper, with dissolution of the idea that there is or was a personality, myself, with so-and-so expectations and weaknesses, guilt will result in true being. You see, it's not the dissolution of the idea that there is a personality with so-and-so expectations. It is the acceptance of the personality. Not the dissolution of the personality. Because we have to live our lives. The personality does not dissolve. It is the sense of doership that dissolves. Yes, of course, the expectations and all drop away of how people should behave and so on and so forth. If not drop away, they become less and less. But everything is embraced in this beautiful teaching. Yes, Abhishek.
Good morning, Gautam sir. How are you?
Good morning. Good, good. How are you doing?
Good, sir. Good. So, sir, I completely understand that all there is consciousness, and everyone, like the basis is the self, which is underlying everyone. So one day there is full understanding and I'm living with total, like my mind is totally fixed on the self, and my thinking mind is not doing the monkey business, and everything is so well understood that yes, by Ramesha teaching, your teachings, Ramana Maharshi's, Sai Baba's, all are pointing to one thing, which is the self, that you are not the body mind, you are the self. But the next day I'm lost that what I understood the day before and now what I'm looking for, like this still a state of blank, that I feel that I have forgotten what I learned day before and I'm still at the same place. But the next day again, things go fine. And I again recall that, okay, these are the concepts. And it's not about being recalling the concepts, but I understand these are the concepts and I truly relate with them. And I truly find peace with them and constantly they're in my head. But the next day, then I say, I'm fed up. My mind is going again and again there. And there is just one thing, like all these are the pointers. As Eckhart Tolle mentioned that all these are the signposts. Once you reach the destination, you discard the signposts, right? They are no longer needed. So I know the destination is the self. where we have to reach, and that is the only thing. But next day again, a lot of thoughts come that I am going there. Then I say, I know that the destination is there. Why so many thoughts again? And then again, I'm going to the destination. So why this flip-flop is happening?
Because you cannot control it. It's God's will, as simple as that. How old are you, Abhishek?
33.
So this body-mind organism called Abhishek has been conditioned for 33 years. Now, let's say you were exposed to the teaching 3 years ago or 5 years ago, whatever it may be. And fresh conditioning was infused, a different way of looking at life's experiences. It is going to take time. The flip-flop is going to happen.
That's natural, right?
It is absolutely natural. Now, for example, since you mentioned Eckhart's name, I remember this girl years ago told me that she was following the power of now for 12 years. I mentioned this before in my talks. Diligently being in the present moment. And one day she had a fight with her boyfriend and it was in the car. And she told him to stop the car. She got out of the car and slammed the door shut and stormed off. And she told herself, there goes my 12 years of being in the now. You see, what does this mean? That the teaching disappeared? No. It means we do not know what happens the next moment. Some event must have happened in the day. Maybe one's blood pressure is up. We don't know how things are linked. The point is that it is the one who has judged that this should not have happened if I was immersed in the path now. That one has to go. You see? We are human beings living a very human life. There's a series of interconnected events. And so we have good days, we have not so good days. What happens with acceptance and living in the moment is an apology can arise that, hey, you know, I didn't really intend to bang that door shut. It just happened and I truly apologize if I've hurt you. You see, one is open. One sees things as they are, but this, why did this happen? It should not have happened. It is a sign that I have not taken to the teachings deep enough and so on and so forth. One's life can get frittered away like that. So it is a natural process. Things are going to play out. The point to be asked is, Abhishek, for all of us, by and large, our degree of peace today compared with sometime earlier and sometime earlier, are we progressively in that duration, one could say, more and more being established in this peace, or are we actually going all over the place and, you know, not really any different from being exposed as we were to the teaching? That is the question to be asked. Where have I found my peace? Am I finding it here or not? And if you find that, yes, by and by, I do see the quality of life has changed, whether it is Eckhart, whether it is Ramesh, whether it is whoever, then one knows that one is on track. As simple as that.
Right. So there is progress, definitely.
That's it. That is your measure.
That's right. So I've been listening to a lot of talks. The day before, what happened is like, I was fed up. I said, let's shut all the talks. I don't want to listen to anyone. Let me abide in the self. So I think that is also the part of the process when, because again, when I'm listening to so many talks, then again, my mind is working, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So let's shut off everything and let's abide in the self for some time. To be in the natural state.
Yes, or have a balance.
Exactly.
Like supposing you say, okay, I allocate maybe an hour or so in the day if I can to listen, because I like listening to spiritual talks. I allocate a fixed time. I don't go like, what is that word? You know, where you really indulge all 24 hours doing something, then you get fed up, you see?
Right.
So the balance middle path is always the best approach. absorb, imbibe the teachings, see how they impact the day to day, and reflect at the end of the day what happened. It should be a nice process, not
exactly.
One of frustration and all, you know. And
yeah.
I mean, one can't avoid it if that happens, but I'm saying that let's try and enjoy ourselves a bit also.
Yeah, the measure is to compare yourself with what you were earlier, right?
Yes.
And if you see progress, then it's good. Things that
yes.
Work.
The measure is important because there are many people who pass decades in pursuing spiritual teachings and practices as well, not knowing how it is benefiting them, you know, and jumping from one thing to another and here and there and there and there. Then it is again becoming just a very scattered kind of progression. The ultimate progression is to progress, if one can use that word, into peace. All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Abhishek. Would anyone else like to ask a question?
Namaste, Gautam.
Yes, Holger.
Yes, quiet.
Your handle says Spiritual Coffee Shop.
Yeah, it's beautiful. We are meeting 10 friends, and we meet 3 times a week. And it's such a gift, so beautiful, just to be with like-hearted people together. It's just grace. It's amazing.
And what is being put in the coffee? That's what I'd like to know.
Just love and peace.
That's nice.
Yes. I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Holger. Thank you very much. You're always very kind.
You make it easy.
Thank you. All right. I'm just going to change the screen so I can see all of you all. There you go. What happened? Satsang is the place for change. You know, it's if one is drawn to it based on one's destiny, it is a place for change. It's like one day in Bhai Sahib's satsang, it's going back into the 60s, I think, someone told him that this man who comes to you out of the many, many who come, he's foul-mouthed, he doesn't know how to behave, he doesn't know to speak. Why are you putting up with him? Why don't you tell him to leave? And he looked very sternly at this Bhai Sahib, turned to this man who said this and said, how dare you? The only reason he has come here is to change. So whoever is drawn to any path, any teacher, any teaching, is drawn. Because whatever they have seen of life and living so far, they have realized that peace has not been found there. So rather than comparing and judging people with different teachers, different paths, this and that, just the knowing that that person has been touched in some way, maybe just mentally, perhaps, maybe intellectually, we don't know. But something has stirred. The drama of life has woken up something which was lying dormant. That is why we are all together. There was a very nice practice I was given by someone. Not really a practice. It's very simple. We can do it right now, actually. those who are on Zoom with me on YouTube, it's not really relevant. It is the difference between seeing and looking. So right now, shift the seeing from looking at an object, in which case it is me as an object right now, to just seeing with no focus on the object. Just the eyes open and seeing is happening through the eyes, but we are not landing the attention on the objects, whether it is me, the computer screen, or whatever it may be. Just seeing. It brings a sense of impersonal seeing, because in that space of seeing, the object that arises is no longer judged, because one is not looking at the object, but one is seeing. And this quality of seeing, when you meet people, when you see places, when you go to the bazaar, you go to a religious place of worship, just pull back and not letting the vision fall on objects, but seeing like a screen, you know, like this whole movie of life is on the screen of consciousness, starts creating a kind of, as Maharaj would say, a wedge between being and experiencing. Because when that happens, one is more and more established in the impersonal presence of seeing, pure seeing, rather than looking at objects individually. It becomes an effortless seeing, not one where the ego is now trying to control the looking into becoming seeing. It's just a relaxation, actually.